Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 95 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. So announcements this week. I think that we can't start anything out without saying they're filming season two. They started filming season two.
DIA has arrived.
It has. It started this Thursday. Week. That was a Thursday. They show, what do they call that? A clapboard?
Or a...
Yeah. Just a shot that had the scene they were filming and stuff on it.
And episode 201.
Episode 201. So exciting. We got a Q&A with Meryl Davis, who is, of course, Ronald Moore's producing partner, known on Twitter as @tallshipsprods. There's transcripts floating around if you're interested and you missed it. They are out there to find.
There are a number, and of course the one that we're going to suggest, just because that's the one we typically read if we can't follow along, and that's that Sarah does with Outlander TV News.
That's right. She's good at doing transcripts. I don't have the patience for it.
She mostly just puts the tweets in there.
God bless her.
You gotta collect them all, though.
Yeah. We got a few new shots from the Outlander Instagram account behind the scenes of the Redcoats attacking the watch party in the crevasse. That's what I'm calling it, the crevasse. Or as somebody in Britain would say, the crevasse. We also got a shot of Katrina looking lovely, and this shot definitely highlights her ample bosom. There's a lot of cleavage in this shot. It's strange. It's like a lot of cleavage without showing anything. Like, it doesn't look like it's that deep of a bodice, but there's a lot of cleavage going on. Just saying. And as her hair gets longer, her 18th century hairdos get better.
Get more authentic.
Yeah. And we also got a shot of Jenny and Claire holding the red coat hostage. They appear to have him propped up over some apple crates. And last but certainly not least, we got another Outlander newsletter today highlighting tonight's episode and, you know, just getting us all primed and ready to watch. We've all already watched it at this point, obviously, but...
We hope you have, because...
Oh my God, if you haven't, spoilers. But that's announcements.
So on to this week's episode discussion. This week we are discussing episode 114, entitled The Search.
And what a search it was.
It was all search. For having no shot of Jamie at all, Sam Heughan, I liked it. It was quite an exciting episode.
Yeah, and like I was saying earlier, the only thing that this episode needed
was Sam Heughan.
I just, it's not a true episode of Outlander for me without at least one shot of that man.
Well, you saw his bat get sewn up, right? In the opening.
That does not count.
Well, that's true, but it's not a nice full shot of him, of his head and his face and everything. Okay, so what's the first thing we usually mention? It's the opening title card, right?
Yes.
And it was so sweet. You know, at first, you might laugh at this, but I know you'll understand what I'm saying, and I will translate it. But
I mean, it's going to be in English, right?
If I have to translate it, probably not. The first thing I thought when they had that opening, you know, little, because it wasn't a still, right? Like last week with the watch, it was the picture of that watch in the bed of leaves.
But it wasn't, I would not have considered that a still. It was a still to me is like a photograph, but this
yes,
was like,
it was a camera.
A camera trained on that.
Exactly. So this was not obviously not a still. I mean, neither were stills, but this was not, there was much movement in this. The camera was still watching a scene
with marionettes.
But the first thing I thought of was Puppentheater.
Oh.
And that may not be the correct... It could be in German, Marionetten.
I'm glad that we discussed what Puppen means, because it sounds a lot like saying poop.
Of course
like
it does.
Puppen.
Puppe, die Puppe, die Puppen is...
It sounds like poop.
Okay, singular die Puppe, plural die Puppen.
And we're not talking about poop.
No, it's German.
Saying
it's German for doll. So I wrote... Puppentheater. So this may be kind of obvious, but you notice that it appeared to be two female marionettes who were doing something to another marionette who looked like almost like a clown, but is that long white outfit, but I'm guessing was male, kind of half lying on the ground there. And there were two standing stones on either side of them. Did you see that?
I remember the stones. It made me think that they were telling that fairy story.
Mm.
The very common fairy story.
Yes, because then it went poof.
But when they saw one of the extended times, version. Actually, it might have poofed the first time.
The poop, poop. The
stop.
The poop and poofed.
Not okay.
There was a puppet on the ground, right? Kind of half reclining, lying down. Between two stones, two standing stones. And then I wrote, poof. So it kind of poofed away. And I did not think, I thought of the standing stones, yes, but I did not think of the fairy story. That is, I like that. I can't wait to hear the, this week's podcast of Ron Moore's and whoever joins him, because we'll find out more about that. Because they always talk about the title card.
Yeah.
That'll be nice to hear, because I... Of course, when you first see it, you're like, what do puppets possibly have to do with anything? But of course, it comes back later on when, as they're traveling, we see them. But
I really wanted that sentence really nice. To have nothing but peas in it.
Which sentence?
What did the puppet possibly, perchance, perceive?
Okay. This episode is brought to you by the letter P.
Exactly.
So we, after the title card, the episode opens... Pretty much where you could say, you know, at the end of the last one.
Maybe not directly at the end.
Not directly, but
exactly where you would think the last one led to.
Yes, Ian's been, not, I can't say healed, but I'm sure Claire and or Mrs. Crook tended to Ian because he had, you know, he had some bandages on, or he was sitting slightly more comfortably on their couch or on their settee, whatever you call it. So he was there. You could see he was wounded, and... Jenny was furiously walking around, you know, giving orders and making things done and getting ready for something. And she asked Mrs. Crook to go milk the goat, right? Because goat's milk is...
One of the few things you can feed to newborn babies.
Yeah. They didn't have a formula back then. But definitely I have heard that goat's milk, I believe, is closer to human's milk than cow's milk. You definitely... I think it's easier for the... For the child's digestive tract to break down. But if you're a nutritionist or a doctor, you know, let us know, because that would be, number one, it's what's available to them, number one. And number two, they're actually nowadays, the science is there, so we can definitely back that up or not. So Claire is set upon going after Jamie herself. Jenny's going about and getting things ready for her absence, meaning her own absence. Ian really wants to go, but of course he's in no shape.
Can I just say, that had me, I actually chuckled at that, because I was like, poor Ian. And I said, but then Claire turned to him and said, you're missing your leg. And I was like,
in two ways.
I said, she's not wrong. Not only is his leg actually missing, but they stole his wooden leg as well.
Know, yeah.
So I was like, it was just the fact that she was so matter-of-fact about it. She's like, you're in no condition to go. And he's like, oh, come anyway. And she's like, you're missing your leg. And he's like, touche.
So Ian really, really wants to help out in some way. And he finally says, okay, if I'm not going to go, then let me draw you a map of approximately where we were ambushed. And so you guys can get at least a decent head start and go in the right direction. You're not just riding around with no idea.
Which is what they do for the rest of the episode.
Well, kind of. But they have a plan, just not aware. We learn the two women leave on horseback.
But and before they leave on horseback, can we just talk about those dual pistols, the like holster that she had on? One in the front, one in the back. I was like, that looks pretty badass.
I was about to say, Jenny was B.A.
Dude.
Jenny, you are just crazy. Yeah. Jenny, I
like messing
her.
Around.
Of course she was.
And I was thinking about it, and I was like, that had to be a much easier, like, kind of a holster to draw your pistols out of than just the side holsters. It was like one in the front and one in the back. You just, I don't know. It seemed very practical to me and badass.
Always. We find out pretty soon that Jenny is a tracker and that she will get them through this. at least until they meet up with someone else. They arrive at the area where the ambush was, right? Near the bridge, under the bridge, near the bridge.
That, it was that, like, crevasse.
Mm-hmm.
That weird crevice they were all walking through.
And they find the dead men who were left. And that,
dude,
that the voiceover, was it Claire's, right? Saying, and she had her own little flashback to, we don't see it, but verbally, memory, to World War II. And she talks about how the victors take their dead, or retrieve their dead, and take them home. If you're on the losing side and you're left to rot. And that's what these men were left to do. And so, were there only two, or were there more than two?
I think we only, there was only,
she only a, prayed only over like two.
Two highlighted in this episode. It's funny that I got stuck on the word eye, because that's what really bothered me, was the crow pecking the eye of that corpse. And at first when they showed the body and they saw the bird there, I was like, ew, that's kind of gross. And then Jenny did her thing. She prayed everybody. And then they went back to the crow, who then was
And you
much,
saw like the dark spots in the face.
It was much more of a close-up.
Yeah, it was a little disturbing.
And I was like...
But I like the effects.
I don't enjoy graphic eye stuff.
You and me both. I don't know if I said this on the podcast before. Ever since at the age of 15 or 16, and yes, it was an accident. It was an accident that I found it, but it was on purpose that I stayed with it, because I could have changed the channel, but I didn't. Eventually, I did.
Is it a surgery?
No. Surgery, because of this, however, I can't watch eyeball surgery. No. At the age of 15 or 16, I was in high school, and for some reason, I was either doing it all night. I don't think I was doing it all night, or I just couldn't sleep. I got up, went in the living room, turned the TV on, and was just going through the channels, and stopped on a Clockwork Orange.
Oh, Lord.
Exactly. I am scarred for eyeball life. I can't... Me and eyeballs, and just that was a little bit too much. So, yeah, I don't appreciate... Well, not appreciate. I don't like... I can watch almost any surgery, and I can watch animal surgeries of the eyes. I've watched it. Fascinating. But I can't watch human eyeball surgeries.
Well,
and other things too.
I think what trips me out about it is that that's like a defining feature telling you whether or not someone is awake
or alive.
Same. Well, if it's a surgery, you're assuming they're alive. You don't do surgery on dead people.
True.
But it's like if somebody has their eyeball open, you generally think they're awake. You shouldn't be doing that right now. You should wait till they're asleep. And then you're like, oh, wait, it's eye surgery. It has to be open. But it's just creepy. It's like sleeping with your eyeballs open. It's the creepiest thing ever.
I caught what she had said, and I thought, she's okay. She's obviously not a priest. She can't give him any kind of last rites. But, you know, what kind of prayer is she looking up? And she only actually did part of it. And I'm not sure if you only need part of it, or it's the intent behind what you do include. But I caught a snippet of it, and I Googled it, and it is...
Did.
Of course, yeah. And I'm sure that there are more than one. There is more than one, but it was a Catholic prayer for the dead, which makes sense because they're, at least in the books, very devout, or Jamie's devout, but a Catholic family.
Papists.
And, yes, papists.
Filthy papists.
If it's the same one, this is what I found. It's just one stanza. God our Father, your power brings us to birth, your providence guides our lives, and by your command we return to dust. So that is, I believe, what it was. It didn't have a title, it just said prayer for the dead. And then I wrote, oh, nasty, that bird was digging out the eyes.
Like, he'd already dug out that one eye.
I didn't notice the birds in the eyeballs the first time. But I guess it was the second time
it's
when
like
they went back.
All I could see, and I was nauseated. Because I had, like, just eaten dinner. And I was like, oh, that's gross. That's not okay.
Jenny finds a trail, and they're off. Clippity-clop. Jenny says she's bursting. And then Claire doesn't say anything, but she's probably thinking, oh, me too. So they stop, and Claire goes to squat, and Jenny pulls them out.
Well, but
which
what
makes
I think
sense.
Is funny, and I don't know if it's funny, but she clearly needed to pee. Got distracted.
Claire? Oh,
yeah, got distracted
Did her
by
need
Jenny
go away?
By Jenny's, you know, boobies,
And then apparently forgot she needed to pee because she didn't pee.
Well, we don't know. She probably peed later on.
I don't know. I think that once she got over the initial shock of what was going on, I've been like, all right, I'm going to go.
I was curious if they were going to keep it. I'm so glad they did because it is part of the book, yes, but it's also realistic that a woman who just gave birth and who's nursing, or not just gave birth, excuse me, 3 or 4 days. Because when they were sitting on the stoop, it was 3 days. And hopefully this is the same day that they're leaving. So probably 3 days. Those were either false breasts.
They were totally false. Those were like prosthetics.
Because they must have been.
They didn't like plumb her real boobs to
I
be
know
able
they
to
didn't, but it was total. It was so. I mean, they definitely looked engorged, but it was like. I was like, they look so real. You couldn't tell where her skin began.
That was crazy good. She did kind of handle them like they were not hers.
Well, they kind of aren't hers.
That's what I'm saying.
A new mother's aren't hers.
Oh, but she's not a first time mother.
That is true. She knows how to milk those puppies.
Right. So it's not a big deal. It's not a big deal. It was just like sometimes in the way she moved them or handled them,
it wasn't kind of natural.
It kind of seemed like they were not her own or she was being very careful with them.
I was kind of curious before I saw it if they would actually show, show like from what a little bit of just above the breast up to her face and show, and then show the milk being squirted in, but not actually coming out of her breast. I'm glad they went for it. But
we should look that up. It looked really dang good. One of the first times they ever showed this on TV. So I'm wondering if their like special effects department was like, they came to work one day. They're like, all right, so today on the docket, we have to make a pair of breasts that will squirt milk out that are worn by an actress. So she has to be able to express milk from her own. Though it was kind of enjoyable for me the several times that you saw her in the episode, like the size of her boobs changed from like the engorged to like not engorged. I thought that was an interesting fun touch because that's honestly.
Did you say fun touch?
Fun touch. Because
I heard
that's,
it. Okay.
That's actually what happens. They get like crazy big and then, once you've fed the baby, they're like, not anymore. And what's funny is when, like, if you were nursing your baby and, like, they fall asleep after one side and then you've got, like, one really big one and one not so big one. It's pretty funny.
So as they're chatting, we find out that Claire thinks that she might be able to bargain with Lord Thomas. And Jenny, I wrote, Jenny thinks that's cute.
Jenny think that cute.
Yeah, don't make fun of my Danglish. Jenny's like, Claire, no, we're going to have to do our best to find him and we'll work together as long as I can. Before what's his name appears, though, you wonder maybe how long Jenny could have lasted. It couldn't have been too much longer. So they hear some soldiers and they see Macquarie in the cart.
Clearly alive.
Oh, very much alive. And,
didn't appear to be that wounded, but he was sitting down, so he could have been injured in his leg or something.
Exactly. Now, Jamie was supposedly, we don't know if he was in the same cart or a different cart, but Jamie was at least captured with him at the same time. But Jamie is nowhere to be seen. One of the men, if you see, I think I caught it my second time because I was looking for it, but the first time, I was just watching everything and not looking for so much detail. One of the men takes a missive and gets on his horse and rides away, or a letter or something. And Jenny makes her plan right then. Jenny's plan is to get a hold of this potential courier. This would be courier, this, but definitely soldier at least, and ply him for information. So she...
Ply, you mean torture him?
Pretty much, yes. Probably what it was a stunt person, but... Man, when she literally, like, threw herself down on the ground in front of that horse, that storyline, real life, whatever, it totally would have been trampled. I mean, what luck do you have that that horse was able to stop? Or the guy, you know what I mean? It was just so close, but it works.
And then what follows is the worst good cop, bad cop.
It's almost comical.
That ever happened because Claire was doing her best to be good cop, but she didn't realize that Jenny wasn't playing at bad cop. She really was the bad cop.
Yeah, exactly. While Jenny and Claire are interrogating the soldier, Jenny is of one mind. Claire, the 20th century woman and healer, is torn. She knows they need the information. She's pretty sure that he potentially has some. And she understands that there might
be some stuff that may have to happen to him for him to share that information. I think she fully expects that they'll let him go once she's given him the answer. And she's trying to, I wouldn't say coddle him, but coax him. Please don't make this harder for her. You know, give us the information and we'll stop and that kind of thing. Absolutely, she's playing or trying to play the good cop. But like you said, I don't think she's trying to play the good cop. She's trying to, because if you're intentionally playing the good cop, you're on the same side as the bad cop, right? Yes. You're just working your role. She's not working her role. She is actually believing that if they're able to get information, or when they do, that they'll let him go. And I don't think it didn't hit her in the beginning. She didn't realize that once they caught him, he was going to have to be killed because he could recognize them and then, of course, share the information of whom they're looking for. He says he's a courier, and eventually, or they find out he's a courier, and they check his satchel, and they find a letter that he's carrying. And from the letter, we learn that Jamie has escaped. And that the letter said was to go to Fort William to tell them that he had escaped and where to search for him, correct? And Jenny is... It took me more time than it took Jenny, but she has the words written for her, so of course she would know this. It took me a beat and a half or two to realize that, well, duh, if you destroy the letter, then the communication can't get to them, and then they won't be searching for him. So they destroy it in hopes that no one from Fort William will come out and be looking for him. So Claire goes to the horse and fully plans, and starts to like gather her healing supplies, and fully plans to bandage this man's wounds, which we haven't said yet what they are. Jenny has basically taken a hot poker to his feet.
Where did she get this poker?
Oh, you didn't watch? She got it from his rifle.
Ah. I vaguely remember that now.
Jenny tells Claire that they can't let the man live. She says, "I'll not be judged by you, Claire." She says, "because it bothers you and there's no room for sentiment here." And as they have their nice little chat, they don't hear a voice. They don't hear a loud noise, but they do hear some kind of struggle, and the guy's feet are moving, and it just looks kind of odd. And they look over, and then the camera looks over, and we see someone is bent over and has sliced his neck. And this is where I got the first tear prick. All I could think was, "Marta!" It was so nice. No, the tear prick wasn't nice. It was great to see him. And then he says... His greeting is basically, "next time, hide your tracks better."
Right. Well, he showed up at just the right time, as
of course he did.
Marta is wont to do.
It's Hollywood. And it's Diana Gabaldon, so of course he will. Jenny tells Claire, "love forces a person to choose. You do things you'd never imagine you'd do before." And isn't that the truth? I mean, Claire says to Jenny then that she wasn't judging Jenny, and that if Murta hadn't come at that time, or hadn't come, she would have killed him herself. I'm not saying she's lying, but I don't know how true that is. I mean, I think she has it in her, ultimately, but I honestly think she would have let Jenny do it. What do you think? Because we don't know. Woulda, shoulda, coulda. But...
I mean... It wouldn't be the first man she's killed.
Claire?
Yeah.
Who's the first?
The English deserter that tried to rape her?
Oh, yeah. But that's...
I mean, it was a different circumstance.
Yeah, absolutely. That was definitely, like, literally self-defense. I mean, you could consider them both defensive. One, acute, like you're about to, you know, die or be raped, etc. Be injured, be attacked. The other... maybe not be hurt by that person that day, but that person's release could definitely bring your own death to you, ultimately, by being free. Even though I just said what I just said, that this is, at least verbally, even if whether she would have carried it out or not, we don't know, but at least verbally, this is the outer proof of an inner change, an inner development in our Claire. She is a healer and feels called to save lives. For her to say this is evidence that she is understanding more of the times she is in. Do you think that this is... obviously, her missing Jamie is one of the first... the witch trial was probably the biggest shift, right? And then her deciding to stay was the first... were the biggest shifts. But, and now that she's there and she's dedicated... she's staying with him, she is now obviously wanting to find him. Do you think that her saying this is more evidence or some evidence that she's, you know, finally starting to understand the importance of, you know, listening to people, keeping yourself to yourself in certain things? Well,
she clearly hasn't learned the lesson of listening to people.
That is true. I meant like listening to Jamie about staying in that glen, you know, just little things that she's, in that case, we understand it wasn't necessarily true disobeying. It was her trying to get back to Frank. So that was a little bit different. But I think it's interesting that we just see with every episode more development here. We see more character development. I love it because the more development we see, which we are always seeing little by little, sometimes jumps, but it's usually little by little for her. To me, it's fulfillment of the story. We learned that Claire learned how to live off the land a bit from her uncle. Jenny learned to trek. I think I already said that. From Jamie and Ian when she was younger. I think Murta, and there was more than one. I did not write them all down. But I think Murta had some of the best lines of this episode. Huh. When coming to the fire with supper, he says, "From what I see, you two are natural outlaws." Now, I understand he was making an observation, but it just made me laugh. It's like, these two women, just, you know, one's built the fire, one's got... what did Jenny do? She did something.
She tortured an enemy soldier.
Well, okay, there's that. I meant right there at the camp. I thought she was doing something, but
she was telling Claire about...
misremembering.
Putting bugs in, or threatening to put bugs in. Oh, yeah. The room, talking about tracking and...
I love that conversation. So in this episode, we get to see obviously more of Jenny and Claire. And of course, we get to see Claire and Murta for so much of the episode. It was a dream. The next day, as they break camp, Jenny has to return home to Maggie.
Oui, Maggie.
She gives Claire the rents from quarter day and Ian's knife. And this was probably... I may have gotten a tear break, I'm not sure, but it definitely gave me shivers. And Claire says in a voiceover that she didn't adore the role of prophet. And I wrote, Claire the prophetess, she tells about the potatoes. When she tells Jamie about where she's from, when she's from, about the future and all these things, the planes, different things that they talked about, that's different. That's not using her knowledge. She is... okay, one example would be the war, right? Culloden. She does tell him that. And it is a warning. But it's almost like a full disclosure kind of thing. Whereas when she's telling Jenny, it's a warning and it's to help them. So it similar in that she tells both of them some aspect of the same thing. She tells Jamie, of course, the everything of it because he knows where it's coming from. But when she starts talking about potatoes and... she mentions the famine and the war. Isn't this the first time, maybe outside of Jamie, that she uses not her knowledge in this way?
Well, yes, I believe so. But I mean, in the show. I mean, other than her knowledge of medicines that she knew outside of that current period. But before, she wasn't planning on staying.
That's true. And there was no need to get people ready for anything.
And she wasn't connected to any of the people the way that she's connected to the people at Lallybroch.
And then, I know I can't say the future thing, but this gives me even more shivers. When Jenny says, Jamie said you might tell me things, and then I was to listen or to obey.
Well, and this was a little different in the books. In the books, yes. Jenny kind of goes up to her and says, Jamie said that you may have some knowledge.
Oh, so she initiates
it. And anything you tell me, I'm supposed to listen to you. So if you have anything to tell me now. And then she's like, where do I start?
That's interesting because I had forgotten that it was initiated that way. And in the books, obviously, we love the books. That's the first thing we read. It's not shocking in any way. But to hear that it is different than how it was done here,
They're both so effective.
Yeah. No, oh my goodness. It didn't goodness. Change anything.
I mean, that's really great to think about. Thank you for saying that, because I wouldn't have remembered, because I would have sworn, no, she told her. Didn't you see it? She told her.
I mean, I did see it.
I know.
But when I read it, it was a little different.
So then Jenny takes her leave. Murta says that Jamie will find them. Claire was like, okay, well, where do we start? How do we even start to be looking for him now that he could be anywhere? And he says, we don't. He will find us. They must attract attention to themselves so that he can find them. She serves as a healer and a fortune teller. This is Murta's plan. They're going around from village to village, cottage to cottage, you know, wherever they can find people, basically. And he lines up people who need to be healed or fixed up, and she does it. And then there's some kind of performance, and he attempts to be involved in the performance, and she does her fortune telling, palm reading thing. I love this so much. We got so much of them performing that it was like, I never ever would have expected this much. And we got only a little bit of gypsy, but I'm glad that they kept the gypsy, the gypsy part. But the only thing we didn't get, and it's totally fine, but it would have just made it like the icing. That's all. Because we got the cake. We just didn't get the icing. Something about her Gladys line. That just would have been funny. It would have been an inside joke, because you don't need it. But it just tickles me every time I read it.
Well, when she started fortune telling, I got confused really quickly, because I was like, this isn't the fortune telling from the book. And I was like, what is she saying? I'm like, she's just repeating everything that the other woman said to her. She wasn't, you know, taking any of the tips and reading the tells of the people she was reading. And then as I started listening to what she was actually saying, I was like, oh, there's a purpose here. I need to shut up and just let her continue. Somebody smarter than me wrote this. Because then I caught on to it. But then I thought, these villages don't get a lot of strangers in them, probably. Mm-hmm. And if she's going from village to village, and people are starting to, you know, they're expecting her, they're like, oh, it's the singing whatever, she also does fortune telling, wouldn't they all talk to each other and realize that she was giving everyone the same fortune? And asking about a redheaded man? Wouldn't That's somebody true. Be like, can I get my money back?
If they all talked about, what did she tell you? What did she tell you? Oh, she told me this. Oh, so we're all supposed to find this man.
A redheaded man. And then with the woman she was giving the fortune to the first time, and she's like, oh, you'll live a long and happy life. And she's like, really? She was clearly disappointed. And she's like, but your husband doesn't. And she gets all happy. She's like, oh, thank you. It's like, that was sad. I mean, clearly her husband doesn't treat her very well. That she was sad she was going to live a long and happy life with a husband she didn't really care for.
Murta, the Highland dancer.
Murta, the miffed being upstaged Highland dancer.
No, hold on a second.
He was so prissy.
He was very prissy, but it made me laugh because he says, did he say I was distracted or they were distracted? The audience.
Both.
He's basically, her fortune-telling at the same time that he danced made him not a good dancer or distracted people. I'm like, oh, Murta, we love you so much.
In the books, though, he was a good dancer.
Okay. No, so I, yeah, but I.
He did a really good job at that particular sword dance. I'm not familiar with it. But in the books, as I recall, he was actually very skilled at it. And she was surprised at how nimble he was.
For one so simian.
Right. So, but I just loved the way that Duncan played him. He was very, like,
you know, okay, everyone
his
likes...
vanity was on display yes, this
yes.
entire episode.
Everyone loves Jamie. That's not even a question. So let's not even include Jamie. You know, and probably too many people know, that my favorite male of the show is Tobias Menzies, the male actor. But he wasn't in this episode, and neither was Jamie. So, I mean, it's pretty easy to say this, I guess. But, I mean, I have liked Duncan Lacroix since we first saw him, before he even opened his mouth, before we actually saw episode one. But I have just fallen in love with his Murta. Tobias Menzies is pretty rock solid and straight on as BJR. I couldn't imagine it done any better by anyone else. I couldn't imagine a better embodiment. Sam Heughan as Jamie is magic. And of course, Katrina Balfe as Claire is in her own universe. As far as people who kind of get you in the gut and, you know, hit you in the heart, in the feeler or whatever, there's just something about Duncan Lacroix as Murtaugh. You know, you like Murtaugh because he helps out. He's in love with, he loves Jamie like a son, we find out later why. But this is, even though it's focused on looking for Jamie, just like The Devil's Mark was Galus's episode, I think this is kind of Murtaugh's episode.
I mean, this is clearly the most he's ever spoken.
That is true.
I mean,
keeping in line with the book.
Yeah.
So, going back a tiny bit, she is, as you said, she uses palm reading as an in to ask about a, quote, redhead strapping man. So she's planting images and thoughts and also gathering information. So as they discuss their plan a little more, he makes some quip. They're talking about going further, moving faster, and he makes some quip about not being able to travel by air. And she retorts, not yet anyway. The look he gives her with that short sound is priceless. If you go back, and I hope someone gifts that. That would be great. His little sound, it's very funny. They continue their travel, and Claire suggests he sing a song. And he's like, what are you talking about? And so she belts out, Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy.
I thought it was a nice choice that it was an appropriate song. It was from mm-hmm. the 40s. Something she would have heard before mm-hmm. she traveled back through the stones. And then I thought it was a super clever choice to use that tune again and then reword it with the whatever they called it. How do you spell that?
There was a sheen in there. So she dresses up as a boy and she sings and she does a decent job and the crowds are loving it because it's definitely, you know, tantalizing. It's not something you see every day, a woman in pants. And literally, or trousers, literally, my first thought was she looked straight out of, she looked like a carabino.
What?
A pants roll.
Oh, she did. She the
A
outfit,
tall one.
That outfit made her look even taller.
I know.
Like, she looked so tall in that outfit, and I don't know why, what the difference between pants and a dress did, but in the dress, she didn't look that tall. I mean, she looked taller than, you know, Jenny. But for whatever reason, when they put her in the pants and the vest and the jacket, she grew so tall.
When she gets on stage for the first time and she just lets the F-bomb out.
Oh, F. I was like, there you go.
There you go. Just set the stage.
It's pretty accurate.
I'm kind of surprised she didn't ask for a whiskey. I would have totally, if I were her and I didn't want to be doing this, I'd be like, okay, because we know she drinks. Come on, Claire. Just, dude, ask for one. Ask for a shot.
I was thinking about it when I was watching there, and she comes out and she's just, oh, F. Is that, that's how and anyone who's ever done theater has had this dream. The dream where you're thrown out on stage, you don't know the lines, you don't know what show you're in, you don't know what you're supposed to be doing, but everyone's just in the audience staring at you and you have to do something. Because I know that feeling and that how that feels, I'm sure that's exactly how that felt for her. That moment of, oh God, I don't know what I'm doing. Why am I here? What am I supposed to be doing? What's my motivation?
So they travel, she sings, and Murtaugh collects money and asks if anyone has seen a redhead. As they arrive in one of the new villages, they see a Highland dancer. And they watch, and he's really good.
I was wondering, though, if this was the gypsy encampment that they stumbled upon. Because they appear to have, like, their own tent.
This is what I just said happened, did happen. However, the person we end up seeing, the gypsy, the main gypsy here, we see peek throughout the crowds at various times when they're traveling.
I mean, that's what makes the whole thing make sense.
Exactly. So after the really good male Highland dancer.
Well, that was so funny because Claire was like elbowing him like, oh, get over yourself. And Mirch is like, he's not that good. And they were all just being all prickly about it. And then they call up the next performer, also being now called the Sassenach. And but it's clearly a Scotswoman with a Scottish accent because she wasn't singing it in British fashion. And Arguably, I would say she was actually, she had a little bit of a stronger singing voice than Katrina. So then Claire gets a little miffed herself that her song has been sung. And I think it was a mixture of, it looked like a little bit of vanity on the one side, because I think that Claire was actually starting to kind of enjoy herself doing it. But also the fact that this was a very special song. This song had purpose. It wasn't just the song that she was singing because, you know, they were trying to make money. Or they were trying to distract people while Myrta was talking to people and getting money while she was singing. It was because this was a song that Jamie would know. And if an English woman was roaming the countryside singing this particular song, he would know that that was her and come find them. And that was Myrta's big plan the whole time.
So after the singing of this Sassenach, who's not Claire, they confront the gypsy. And she reveals that she is doing this for love. The gypsy's like, what is it? Is it politics or love? She says, well, it's not politics. And they chat a little bit, and he says, basically, it's very noble. And one thing, only thing that gypsy loves more than money is, or is find more important than money, is love. And she asks him to not perform it anymore, because they have a goal, and look, as soon as I find my husband, I will never be on stage again. You can have the song. You can do whatever you want. But here, I'm going to give you this bundle of money. Please do not. And he says he won't. He says, okay, I'll give you my word. And Myrta's like, I'm not having it.
Just threw your money away.
Exactly. Claire, as they're walking away and Myrta gets after her, Claire says that she has to believe that someone will keep their word. Because otherwise, it's basically, if I don't, then do I go on? Do I not go on? Because if I don't, paying him was another thing. But if she asks someone for something and they give their word, if she just does not trust their word or doesn't think that they'll keep it, then that's the same thing as not asking and never knowing. And just, she has to believe that in order for them to continue their trip. And what they're doing. Because it has to happen for them to be successful, she believes. And Myrta definitely believes. I guess the worst thing here is that she paid him. Because he was going to sing whether she paid him or not.
Right.
So that was the worst thing, was that she lost their money. She also gets a talking to by Myrta about trusting gypsies. And I found it... I only noticed it, or I guess I listened... I just picked it up the second viewing. That basically Claire pulls rank. She says, look,
oh, yeah,
I'm the lady to your laird. We're going to do this. We're going to keep going until we find him. Because Myrta's like, look, you just gave away all our money and you just stopped any chance we had of doing this. He's definitely not going to stop now. Now, what's funny is if she hadn't paid him and they hadn't confronted the gypsy, would the gypsies have kept doing it? Because they were only doing it for money, because they were getting money.
But if Myrta and Claire had been smarter, they would have just tracked the gypsies around and let them keep singing it.
Oh, that's, there you go. Claire, you gotta think about things first. And then they're riding around, they get to the ocean, or the sea, which is has to be, because from what he says, has to be on the west coast of Scotland. And Myrta says, if you look hard enough, you might see the Americas. It's the only place they haven't sung that damn song yet. Again, he gets the good lines. I love it. And I thought, oh, it's funny they mention America. At the fire that night, Myrta blames her for their current situation, basically since her interaction with the gypsies. Claire says perhaps he thinks it's been fine, because he's never lost someone that he's loved. I don't think she thinks that he's heartless, but I think she thinks, because she doesn't know anything about him, that, oh, basically, Myrta, it's easy for you to say don't do this and don't do that. Here I am. I have to be actively doing something. Even if it's a long shot, I need to be active in trying to find and save my husband.
I know, but I thought her saying that was really assumptive on her part. She doesn't know him.
No, absolutely. And we find that, and we find out. And so she is assuming, oh, because you're not fully supportive of what, the 100% of what I'm saying we need to do right now,
you obviously have never loved anybody. Because if you had, you would know what I'm feeling and you would want to help me or whatever. And he basically tells her, let me tell you something. We hear Murata tell the story of the woman he loved. He lost someone at the Mackenzie gathering many years ago. She had another suitor. He tried to be the type of man he desired. He killed a boar with a a man she desired. He killed a boar with just a dagger. And he was rewarded by the laird, correct?
Yes.
He got both of the tusks, yes, and he had them made into bracelets, and he gave them to the lass as a wedding gift. So he didn't give them to her to
win her.
Win her. It was already gone. She had a suitor, and he knew she was going to choose. Who would have been who? Brian Dew.
That's true.
Brian Fraser.
I want you to know that this week, Outlander Kitchen posted a recipe for...
They were stunning.
They were like...
The boar tusk bracelets.
The boar tusk bracelet. Boar tusk bracelets. And they were actually terrifying to look at because they actually looked just like the bracelets.
They did. They looked amazing.
They were like asparagus, I believe, wrapped in like bacon and puff pastry.
Oh my gosh.
They looked
Except for the bacon. Even the bacon. I'm a vegetarian, but even the bacon. Come on. I mean... I do miss the bacon. I don't eat it, but I love the smell. But I eat fake bacon, so obviously I still miss it. But oh my gosh, that sounds divine.
But every time I look at the actual boar tusks in the series now, all I see are those asparagus with puff pastry and bacon.
So the person that he was in love with was Ellen Mackenzie.
Jamie's mother.
Dougal's and Colm's sister. And Jocasta's niece. Heard about her once. We've only heard about her once. But I had to put that in there. And, yeah, Jamie's...
Janet and Jamie's mother.
Yes. And it was a wedding gift. Ellen's wedding to Brian. When she brings out the bracelets, what a reveal. To see this on screen was perfection. And I don't mean just the bracelets. I mean to see her there with them and to see him see them. He gives us a short, breathy eye, just like Jamie. Did you notice that? Mm. Oh my goodness, so wonderful. We'll have to ask Agav about that too, because now that we heard about the other one. Murta loves Jamie like a son, we learn. Claire loses her composure for the first time in a week. There's probably the stress and the emotion and everything, but, I mean, we don't know that she's broken down. She could cry herself to sleep every night. We don't know this. But in this episode that the scenes that were shown, she is the first time she like full on breaks down. I mean, she's sobbing. So what's the plan? Keep on keeping on. Murta says somehow they'll manage. At yet another village, Claire, the fortune teller, is confronted by the gypsies. They full on admit up front they'd broken their word and sung her song. When they're performing, they tell her someone gave a message to the lass who was singing. And he said, the message was meant for you. Or for her. The message was, you're to go to Glen Rowan Cross with all due haste. Claire says, thank you, from one gypsy to another. I thought it was a very touching line, but it did... I did think a bit about... this whole thing. So, according to Murta and Claire at the middle point, you can't trust gypsies, correct?
Yes.
And, I mean, technically, they broke their word. He said, I will not sing it if you pay me, and he obviously sang it. So that is breaking his word. However, he also was quite... vocal about how much gypsies honor love, just below money. Obviously, there's money involved. But did you have a thought that although they technically broke their word, he did it to help her?
He broke his word to help her?
No, they sang the song to help her. You don't think so?
Mm-mm.
Because if there are two people... or whatever, you know, finding, doing the song, right? They're basically covering twice the amount of ground.
They are, but they're not. And it's not helpful because... Because
you have... It's like split.
Yeah, they weren't in the same places. That doesn't help Jamie find Claire. Because it didn't.
Well, it didn't.
He was... And we'll talk about that in a minute, but... It didn't.
It helped someone find them, though.
No, it helped them find the gypsies. And it's only because the gypsies... brought the tail back to them.
That's what I'm trying to say. They didn't have to bring the tail back to them.
But I don't think that was their purpose when they started. I don't think they were like, let's keep singing so we'll get some extra ground and maybe help them find this
man. I think they wanted the money. Well, not just her money, but to keep earning their own money. So that, I'm not saying they decided to keep singing because they wanted to help her find her love. What I'm saying is, I'm wondering if from the time he learned about her missing spouse... And that he got the money, if he thought, okay, well, we're going to keep singing because this is what we're already going to do. We're going to do what we want. But because of what she said, and maybe because of the money, maybe not, that she gave him, maybe not, if we find anything out, like what happened, if we get a message... We will share it with her. We're not going to keep... It doesn't... They don't get any money or fame or glory or anything by keeping that message to themselves.
No.
It doesn't help them.
I don't think that was their purpose. I think that when it came down to it, they were like, I feel bad. We took her money and did it anyway. So we'll do the right thing and go see if we can get some more money out of her and give her the information. Because that's what he wanted.
That's true. He wanted money, and she's like, no way, Jose. No, that I get. So, okay, so get the money, keep on singing and making more money, and then if we get information, even better, because we're going to get more money.
It's like two blackmailers, two episodes.
Oh, heck yeah. And then with this information, they're off again to the location.
Oh, and the name was an Aberdeen?
Maybe.
Something like that, because they sing it in the song, and that's where... Oh, it comes up later. Never mind.
It's okay.
I'll tell you in a minute.
So they get to the location, and of course, it is Dougal.
It is Dougal.
Now, in the book, it's in a cave.
This was a cave.
Was it a cave?
This was a cave.
Because it looked very...
This was a cave.
It looked very...
Cave-ish.
Like a
cave.
A castle-y... It wasn't a castle, but like a cave. Like a crevasse-y building.
It was a cave.
Whatever it was a storage space, basically.
It was a cave.
A storage space.
Where they were...
Storing things. Exactly.
A
storing
cave. Things. Where they were storing things.
So Dougal says he has news. He says, I couldn't send for you by name and risk my location being found by those unsympathetic to the cause. So, with just that line, he doesn't have to say anything else. But with the line, you hear the word cause and then link basically risk... My name. We know it has to do with the Jacobite cause, correct?
Yeah.
And risk my location being found. Well, so it's not just a risk that he is a Jacobite. It's also a risk that they find something. And what's so special about that location? Well, it's similar to in the book. It's basically where he's hoarding supplies, right? Did you see all those weapons around? Now, I don't know if they had money there. They didn't show us money, right?
But I mean, if they did have money, been in barrels, it wouldn't just be like
laying around.
Like it wouldn't just be like mounted in a pile
on
a table.
No, it could be in a.
It would be in a chest or a box or something.
But yeah,
they don't keep it Scrooge McDuck style.
No,
like a big vat of coins that they can swim in.
We learned that Jamie was caught by the Redcoats, and is at Wentworth Prison. He was on his own since he had escaped, and he literally. Turned the corner and ran into six.
Well, what Dougal said was that he'd heard about the traveling Sassenach and was on his way to Aberdeen.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that's the name of it. So that they sing that the song's name was Aberdeen. Mm-hmm. And he was on his way to Aberdeen when he walked around the corner and ran into the Redcoats.
And just like dumb luck, I mean, he's able to escape. I mean, gracious. So we also learn that he already stood trial 3 days before and was condemned to hang. And when that hanging would take place, basically, he said, yesterday, today, tomorrow? It's basically any time.
Yeah, he's like, it could have already happened.
Yeah.
It could be happening. It could be tomorrow. But I thought that that was interesting. The news of Jamie, while not great news, was equal parts joy. He's not dead. He's alive.
Exactly.
Horror. He could be dead now or tomorrow or the next day.
Yeah.
And guilt, because he was on his way to Aberdeen when he got caught. And he was on his way to Aberdeen because you were singing a song about Aberdeen.
Well, she was, but it could have been them. It could have been the gypsies. Who knows what the one that we heard.
Well, the gypsies would never have known the song about Aberdeen.
They started it. Sure. Yeah. So Dougal wants to have a word with Claire alone. He asks her to come back with him to either to his home or to Leah or to somewhere where him, so he can protect her, of course, to marry him. She brings up Galus, but he says, we won't talk about Galus today. And I thought, aw, I know the information that in the book that he gave her, some of it regarding Galus, was already given to Claire by Galus in The Devil's Mark. I get it. But I can't believe we heard nothing about Galus. So I'm guessing the writers or Ron want us to, without saying anything, be left with the image of her being taken out of that trial to be burned. That's what they want us to leave with, correct?
Yeah.
I'm guessing the rest of the season, because there's no reason to bring her up the next two episodes. So, she has been burnt at the stake with her bebe. Dougal convinces Claire. Did she agree to marry him in the book?
No.
I didn't think so.
I pulled that chapter up.
I was
up.
Like, am I misremembering?
And this was in that, On the Road to Beaulieu.
Yeah.
No, this was actually, that was the first part, and then this was the second part after that, which was, it was Dougal's story, or Dougal's confession.
Yeah. Dougal's confession.
And he clearly tells her, you know, yeah, I'll take care of you. You can come back with me to my house. I'm not going to take you back to Cranesmere, obviously, but you'll go back to my house. I'll take care of you, and I'll marry you, and blah blah blah. And that's when, you know,
she's like,
she
what?
Starts
like, no way,
putting it together about the whole
everything
Lollybrook thing, and he. In the book, he sounds, like, outraged about it at first. He's like, what?
He, like, full-on comes on to her, doesn't he?
He does afterwards. In the book. He changes his tactic, because first he's, like, he pretends to not have any idea what she's talking about. And then he switches tactics. And he's like, you know, I've always kind of liked you. You know, ever since that night at the gathering when I kissed you. They didn't mention that, because she then followed that up with, you know, breaking a chair over his head in the series, but... Yeah.
So he convinces her that if Jamie dies, she'll have no way of being safe. Randall would come looking for her. And she realizes that what Dougal wants, besides her body, although he didn't really take that tactic, but he wants her, is control of the Phaser lands. And that's what he's wanted all along. Why he kept Jamie away for years, why he told him his sister bore Randall's child. So, like, you're right, she's putting all of this together. And something that is not in the episode, it may come up later, is the importance of the Phaser land. It's not just like, oh, I want more land. There is something, and this is not really a spoiler, I won't say what it is, but there is something very particular about the Phaser lands, about those lands. Because it's not all Phaser lands.
No,
it's just Lallybroch.
It's the placement of it is...
Of Lallybroch, yeah. And whatever lands Brian Phaser owned or got from the Old Vox is that. And we don't need to say what the importance is. It's definitely not a spoiler to say it, but there is something very special or very important about the placement of the lands and why Dougal wanted it. But remember, Dougal's a Jacobite. So, those two things.
I thought you were going to say, like, jackass for a second.
Oh, no.
Dougal's a jackass. I mean, he kind of is.
And then I wrote, Dougal brings it home. What would Jamie want you to do? I'm like, WWJD. What would Jamie do?
Claire's like, he wouldn't want me to sleep with my aunt with his uncle.
And then they talk about it, and she considers it. She says, tell me I'm wrong, that he wouldn't want me to do this. Then she asks, has a thought, how many men do you have? He says, 10. And she says, Jamie had only a handful of men when I was rescued at Fort William. She thinks she wouldn't need that many to break Jamie out of prison. I think they're like apples and oranges, but prison and the fort. I mean, who knows? We didn't travel there. She says she has to try and save him if there's a chance. But if she fails or if he's already dead, she will marry him. Now, before you say anything,
How much do you want to bet that she's thinking, nope, if he's dead, I'm going back to those stones?
Well, duh. I mean, she won't have to worry about Randall. She's going to go get a one-way ticket back to the 1940s, I would think, if that happened.
Back to her own Randall.
Yeah. So, the one thing that they left out, and it may come back, I mean, it could totally be something that they have this conversation in the next episode, is when they're deciding to go, she's talking to Dougal, and he's like, you know, I'm not going to go with you, but I'll give you this money. And she's like, well, we want to take some of your men. And he was like, well, you can't take my men. And she's like, well, what if they agree to come with us?
Yeah.
And he goes, okay, well, you can take the ones who agree to go with you. And she goes, and if they all agree to come with me, I'll give you your money back.
Yes.
And he's like, well, yeah, it's not going to happen. But then when Murta comes back in, he's like, and he's saying, we're going. Dougal's like, this is a suicide mission, basically.
Yeah.
And Claire's like, well, then what will you do if it is? And he says, I'll bury you each by either side of him if you fail.
That's true.
And I loved that imagery of him saying, you know, that these, you both love this man so much that if you go in there and you try to get him out and you all die because of it, I will make sure that you all die together. I'll make sure you lay to rest together.
He and Jamie.
He said that he would bury the three of them together. Claire on one side, Jamie in the middle, and Murta on the other.
I love that. I mean, I don't love it that they're dead, but I like
the... I just like the imagery the thought of it. That Dougal had a little bit of honor to him, even though he was trying to shtup his nephew's wife.
So she goes out with Murta, and she is asking and begging them to... if they would go with her and try to break Jamie out of Wentworth Prison. And I wrote, the Mackenzie posse is saying no. Wee Willie is the first to buck up. And then Angus and then Rupert. It's just... And the only reason... Not that they don't like Jamie, but the only reason those two did is because they couldn't be shown up by Wee Willie. So... But look how she shames them into it. But who cares? She got him there. I wrote, hey, it works. Do it. Go get Jamie.
Well, in the books, I mean, it doesn't really matter the order in which it happened. I thought it was definitely a little, considering he was the youngest of the group, I thought it made sense to have him be the first. But in the books, it was Rupert.
Yes, it was.
And he's like, okay, let's go. And then everyone else just kind of followed suit after that. So mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting that they made him the third out of the three main ones to say anything, considering in the book he was the first one who was like, let's go get him.
And then they ride off, and we get the final shot is a shot of Wentworth. Whew.
That is a very, and that's Linlithgow Palace is what it's, the name of this place they use, and that is a very imposing and terrifying looking structure, especially the way that they have it lit.
Oh, yeah.
And that was episode 114, The Search. Brace yourselves, people. Next week is Wentworth.
If you've read the books, you know to brace yourself. If you haven't,
just brace yourself.
Just
brace yourself.
That's probably the only thing you could say.
Buy some tissue. You might need some whiskey.
Whiskey is pretty much always, or your drink of choice. Obviously, whiskey is very, very well placed, well themed, very appropriate for watching Outlander. But basically, anything that helps you relax a little bit or takes it like. Because nervous shivers away.
Anywhere this show has taken you so far, if you haven't read the books, that's made you even slightly uncomfortable. You haven't
seen you ain't seen
you haven't seen anything yet.
We also can't forget that we will be sharing the rest of our Ron Moore interview next week.
Oh.
Because our questions we had to hold were related to the next episode. So thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous audio host, Audioboom.com. Our Audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/OutlanderPod.
Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/OutlanderPod. Or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.